I think we can get started. First of all, our Harriet Bishop person, Yvette Oldendorf, is sick with the flu, but we do have with us this evening Joanne Ray and Ann Colley Boardman. And the general subject on which both of them are going to speak is women writers in Minnesota, from gentle women to professional writers. And of course, writing was a profession that was, or at least an occupation, that it was acceptable from really the 19th century on for women to be engaged in. It was considered respectable. It was something that didn't cost a great deal of money. If a woman had a pen and some paper, she could do it. It didn't represent a great drain on the family exchequer. And she could do it in the comfort and quiet of her own home, and that didn't require her to go out into the madding crowd, which was considered not quite respectable in the 19th century. And really, beginning in the 1830s and 40s in the United States, a great many women made some reputation and a little money by writing novels, writing for magazines, ladies' magazines for the most part. And in the 1840s, Nathaniel Hawthorne, who considered himself quite another kind of writer indeed, referred more than once with some indignation to the damned mob of scribbling women. One of the scribbling women was, of course, Harriet Beecher Stowe, whose novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, was, well, Abraham Lincoln slightly exaggerated when he called Harriet Beecher Stowe the little woman who made this great war. But certainly Harriet Beecher Stowe, very much in the tradition of the 19th century gentlewoman writer, wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, also a novel very much in the tradition of the sentimental, genteel female novelist. And that particular novel, of course, did have an extraordinarily wide impact. And Harriet Bishop, about whom you heard early in the series, whom you heard discussed chiefly as a school teacher, was one of Minnesota's first members of the damned mob of scribbling women. And she did write. She wrote poetry. She wrote essays. And she also very much in the tradition of the sentimental, genteel woman novelist who found only good in almost everything. This evening, we're going to talk chiefly about 20th century women writers in the state of Minnesota. And first, I'd like to introduce to you Joanne Ray, a writer and editor who is presently editor of The Horticulturist magazine. And she's going to talk to us on Maud Hart Lovelace. Joanne?
I first became acquainted with the books of Maud Hart Lovelace in 1941 when I was attending Lincoln School in Mankato, Minnesota. And I can still remember the excitement with which our teachers and other grown-ups greeted the first Betsy Tacy books for children, which began appearing in 1940. There was a great deal of talk about how the books were written by a woman who had been born and raised in Mankato and who had based her stories on the lives of real people who had lived in our little town, which she called Deep Valley. I may even have met Mrs. Lovelace then. My memory is cloudy. I seem to have a recollection of her visiting Mankato, and I know now that she did visit about that time and talk to students in Lincoln Grade School. I can't be sure, for as a six-year-old, what made the most lasting impression on my mind was not the talk by adults, but was the books themselves. I read them, and immediately for me, as for thousands of children then and since, three little girls named Betsy, Tacy, and Tib became real children whose lives became an intimate part of my own childhood. I think all of us here would probably have difficulty in agreeing on a complete set of criteria by which we would judge a book great. Yet I think most of us would agree that one test of greatness is the ability of an author to create people, places, and incidents that transcend time, that are vivid in the minds of generations of readers, and that affect our imagination so powerfully that they forever color and affect our response to certain places and events. Thus, I mean, who can think about Russia during the Napoleonic Wars without thinking of Bolkonskis and Rostovs? Or who can look at the Mississippi south of St. Louis without thinking of Huck Finn? Or nor can I walk past Mankato's little pie-shaped Lincoln Park, past the old 1900 homes, up the hills which look out over the Minnesota River Valley, without thinking of Betsy and Tacy and Tib, and all the wonderful and some difficult times that they had in this town 3/4 of a century ago. Before going further, I should say that Maud has written many other books besides the Betsy Tacy series, including several adult novels. And that perhaps among adults in Minnesota, those who have not read the Betsy Tacy books, she's best known for Early Candlelight, which was published in 1929 and tells a romantic story set in the early days of Fort Snelling. This is a well-written, historically accurate book, and I recommend it to anyone interested in Minnesota history. But her adult works are not classics, and her Betsy Tacy books are. There is a tendency, I think, to treat the writing of children's classics as perhaps not quite a significant accomplishment as writing successful adult fiction. Yet, as anyone knows who has written or tried to write, creating stories for children, stories which are capable of entering into the imaginative life of generation after generation of young readers and remaining there throughout their adult life, requires great literary gifts and an artist's insight into the minds and hearts of her young readers. And children's classics are rare. Among American works, how many would we include that were written for young children with a special interest for girls? I suppose the Little House on the Prairie series, the Little Women, a few more perhaps, and most certainly the Betsy Tacy books. When I returned to the books as an adult and began rereading them to my own daughter, I was impressed again with their beauty and humor. How well they recreate for us what the world is like for a child. How glorious and golden and full of excitement and endless possibilities the world is when we are young and having a happy childhood. On many occasions, Maud has said that she lived the happiest childhood a child could possibly know. And she also insists she was born to be a writer. And she began writing stories and poems when she was still quite a young child, actually just 5 years old. In many ways, Maud stands as a contradiction to the title of this series, Women Searching for Self in Minnesota, or Minnesota's Women, Their Lives, Laws, and Policies in Conflict. Maud very early identified herself as a writer. And while she struggled, as I guess all of us do, to discover her real self, she always had this idea of herself as a born writer, and that her goal in life should be to develop this inborn talent for writing. Nor were there serious conflicts in her quest to become a writer. Not that she didn't have to work very hard, but there were not unusual or tremendous obstacles in her path. On the contrary, there were many circumstances of her life that encouraged and supported her. For a born writer, she was a lucky woman indeed. I assume many here in the audience are concerned about helping women excel in professional and career roles, and I would like to talk a little bit about these circumstances which were such positive forces in helping Maud become a writer. First was her time and place. She was born on April 25, 1892, in Mankato. Much has been written and said about this time, which is pejorative. It was, after all, the heyday of Victorianism and manifest destiny. But it was also a time when man was viewed as a remarkable creature, capable of great accomplishments. Mankato was only 40 years old when Maud was born, and in 1902, when she was 10, the town celebrated its semicentennial. A special celebration was held and a book published commemorating the town and its citizens. And in reading this book, it's interesting to note that while pioneer bravery against the Sioux uprisings and other hazards was praised, there was no longing for past glory. On the contrary, what was marveled at was the glorious present, that in only 50 years this remarkable civilized town of Mankato had been built, that it had churches and schools and colleges and public parks and prosperous citizens and businesses. As an aside, I should mention that the quality of education in Mankato was fairly high at that time. Maud went to a coeducational high school, which emphasized, I suppose, what we would call a traditional or academic education. And among the outstanding teachers she recalled were women with New England background and training. In fact, it could very well be that some of these women were like Harriet Bishop and sent out by the National Popular Education Society, which was a New England organization which devoted itself to supplying competent women teachers for frontier Western settlements. At any rate, the principal speaker at Mankato Semicentennial noted that the bold frontiersman had passed from the scene, but that his departure should not be mourned. For he said, how much better for mankind's happiness was the planting of a civilized community in which justice, law, liberty, and refinement might find a perpetual home. Maud's father owned the book, which contained this speech and others, and she later recalled how she had read and reread this book and how she had loved its stories of bravery and hardship. Thus, very early, her romantic imagination was stirred. She lived in a time and among people who valued achievement, intellectual as well as material. We can feel confident that she did not overlook this statement by the same speaker just quoted. The early pioneer, he said, will hereafter be the victim of the novelist. If there was an unstated assumption that novelist was masculine, the young Maud didn't make the distinction, nor did her family, which brings me to a second very positive force in Maud's life as a writer, her family. Maud's father was Thomas Walden Hart, a partner in a wholesale retail grocery business in Mankato. He later owned and operated a shoe store, and in 1904 was elected treasurer of Blue Earth County. He was a successful businessman and one who had inherited from his pioneer mother an intense respect for education. Outstanding in the memory of those who knew Maud and her family was the loving closeness of the Hart family. Thomas Hart was very proud of his family and generous all his life with the financial and emotional support in helping his daughters achieve in their chosen field. Mrs. Hart, who was born Stella Palmer in Winnebago, Minnesota, had in her background a situation which became very influential on Maud's ambition to be a writer. Mrs. Hart's father had died when she was a young girl, and her mother later remarried. Mrs. Hart had a brother, Frank, who did not get along well at all with his stepfather. Frank was a talented man with musical writing and theatrical ability. He eventually ran away from home at age 17 and sang for a time with the Andrews Opera Troupe, which perhaps many of you who know Minnesota history are familiar with. His sister, Maud's mother, talked a great deal to her daughters about their uncle Frank, and she encouraged all their artistic interests with stories of their talented uncle. Maud later said that her uncle became strongly identified in her mind with her ambition to be a writer. And it was her uncle who actually helped her sell her first story when she was 19 years old and visiting him in California. Her uncle's conflict with his stepfather and his experience with the Andrews Opera Company later formed the basis for the plot in Maud's first novel, The Black Angels. Thomas and Stella Hart had three children, all girls. The oldest, Kathleen, was 3 years older than Maud and had from an early age found music her great love. She was an accomplished piano player and singer, and later studied music in Europe after her graduation from high school. It was through Kathleen that Maud's ambition to leave Mankato and achieve in what they called the great world was reinforced. Maud was the middle daughter, and Helen, 6 years younger than Maud, was the baby. And with such determined, talented older sisters, we can perhaps sympathize with her lack of driving ambition and her exasperation when people kept asking her what she wanted to be. She says, "I don't want to be anything," she's quoted as saying. Sometimes we think of intense ambition, such as Maud's, as being incompatible with happiness, and of course it can be if it comes in conflict with much in one's environment. But happily for Maud, these conflicts were minimal, and she looks back on her childhood as truly a golden time. There was her loving, supportive family, and there was the place in which she lived. All those who have read her books know that Deep Valley is a wonderful place to live, and Maud makes it clear that Deep Valley and Mankato are the same. She is called Mankato idyllic. I had the opportunity of visiting Maud last year in California, where she now makes her home. She was 82, and it was December, about this time of the year, and there were roses outside her window and snow-capped mountains in the distance, and Mankato seemed very far away indeed. I asked her what she remembered most about her childhood home, and without a minute's hesitation, she said, the hills. The hills of Mankato were green in Maud's time and rose up beside and behind her house at 333 Center Street. The little home is still there, by the way. It would be hard to overestimate the force of these hills on the young Maud Hart, producing sights and sounds and smells to live in memory for a lifetime, and stimulating her imagination with visions of the great world beyond and the secure and happy world within. She has described them again and again in her books. In spring and summer, they were abloom with flowers. In the fall, they were all red and golden bronze, and in winter, shrouded in snow. And unlike mountains, they could be climbed and sat upon, run upon, picnicked upon, played upon, and coasted down. At the top of the hill, behind Maud's house, she could sit and look down and see the whole town spread out. See the roofs of the schoolhouse and of her own and neighbors' houses, Front Street, the big mill, Sibley Park, and far away, deep in the valley, the river which led to the great world. When one is a happy 5-year-old, days are very long, but not long enough for all there is to do. There were picnics on the big hill, stories to make up, endless pretend as well as real adventures. And best of all, there were best friends with whom everything was shared. Across the street from the Hart House lived a large, merry Irish family, which included among its numerous children a girl Maud's age, Frances Kenny. She had long red curls, which often covered her face, for she was very shy. With Maudie, however, she was not shy. She was a sympathetic and devoted friend with whom one shared all the joys and sorrows of growing up. She was the real-life model for Tacy. And there was a third companion, a tiny girl with fluffy yellow hair and round blue eyes, who, despite her sprite-like appearance, was thoroughly practical and competent and fearless. She lived in a chocolate-colored house with a tower and a pane of colored glass over the door, which was a wonderful, magnificent home to her friends. Her name was Marjorie Gerlach, and she was the real-life model for Tib. Together, these three achieved that ideal relationship, lifelong friends. From the Betsy Tacy books, we have a fairly complete account of the growing-up years of these three. But as Maud quotes Longfellow in the preface to one of her books, all things must change to something new, to something strange. In 1910, Maud graduated from Mankato High School. Her friends scattered, and she herself went away to the university at Minneapolis. Within the year, her family also moved from Mankato to Minneapolis, and the world was never quite the same, nor quite as idyllic again. Maud was to find, as I guess all of us find, that the achieving of goals is never quite as satisfying as dreaming of them and striving for them. There is no question but what the years following the move from Mankato were difficult for Maud. She was ill during her freshman university year with appendicitis, and her family sent her to California, where she visited her grandmother and Uncle Frank, and with his help sold her first story. She loved California, but on returning to Minnesota and to the new family home in Minneapolis, she found it very difficult to adjust to life as a university student. She was discouraged by being a year behind her friends, and she later wrote that it seemed unjust that she had to take higher algebra when she considered herself already a professional writer. She did have some valuable experiences at the university, however. She was women's editor of the Minnesota Daily, and she wrote for the Minnesota Magazine, a student publication, and one of her stories attracted the attention of Professor Mariah Sanford, who wrote her a letter praising the story and urging her to work at developing her writing ability. Maud's father recognized that she was restless and, feeling that travel might help her in her writing, sent her to Europe. She has written a book entitled Betsy in the Great World, which is based on this year abroad. And part of the plot of the story involves a romance with a young Venetian, and evidently much of this romance is based on fact. She told me last year that the young man was handsome and talented and evidently very serious about her, for he followed her back to the United States and traveled to Minnesota to meet her family. She quoted her sister as saying, "How could you ever have refused to marry him?" She didn't answer that question for me, but one could speculate that Maud would not allow herself to marry anyone if it would mean conflict with her writing. It was writing, in fact, which brought Maud together with the man she did marry, Delos Lovelace. In 1917, Maud went to work writing publicity material for a Mrs. Harry B. Wakefield, who was directing a money-raising effort to aid the Belgians. Delos was a young man from Brainerd who had had considerable newspaper experience, and he was also writing for Mrs. Wakefield. Mrs. Wakefield was a great matchmaker, and she invited Delos and Maud to dinner at her house, and this was the start of a whirlwind courtship, which began that spring of 1917 and culminated a few months later in their marriage in November of 1917. The next summer, Delos left for the Great War, returning safely in 1919, and during the 20s, Maud and Delos left Minnesota to seek their fortunes in New York, where they made their home until Delos retired from the New York Sun in the early 1950s, when they moved to California. Delos and Maud were both writers and united in their desire to see themselves and each other succeed as writers. They were very supportive of each other. Just last year, Maud described how she had helped Delos to be more persistent in his efforts to be published. And she has a number of times credited Delos with suggesting that she turn from short stories to novels, where she was to prove herself successful with early Candlelight, among others. Delos and Maud also collaborated in writing some historical novels, Gentlemen from England and One State at Welcome. Again, these would be of interest to anyone interested in Minnesota history. I asked Maud last year if she'd ever felt any conflict in her desire to be a writer and in being a woman. She very quickly said no, that on the contrary, there had been advantages, and for her there were. Delos and Maud had a traditional marriage in the sense that both believed that the man should be the breadwinner. To make one's living as a fiction writer was surely as difficult then as now, and Delos naturally looked to journalism as his career, and writing stories as something to be done in his spare time. Maud, on the other hand, had much more time for writing and was encouraged, even urged by DeLosse, to use as much as possible for writing. After 14 years of marriage, Maud and DeLosse became parents of a daughter, Marion, and as their daughter began to mature to ages 4 and 5, Maud went into something of a writer's slump. She wrote that she had found her daughter so interesting, so fascinating, that she had no interest or enthusiasm for writing. But when Marion reached the age when she enjoyed bedtime stories, Maud turned to her own blessed childhood, and from telling these stories, she turned to writing them down, and thus the Betsy Tacy books were born. Earlier in this series, I attended one of the sessions, one of your speakers referred to the fact that today, in this period of changing roles for women, women themselves are in key places for helping to affect changes in women's attitudes and expectations. We are, after all, mothers, and also often elementary school teachers, and as such, we are in charge of children during their early formative years. We are also aware of the importance literature can have in this early formation of attitudes and expectations. How fortunate that we have books like the Betsy Tacy series, which recreate for us what it was like to be a child growing up in Mankato at the turn of the century. And that although these stories come to us from an experience 3/4 of a century ago, they recreate for us the young Maud and her friends, all little girls, who saw the great world as an exciting and wonderful and challenging place just waiting to be conquered, of course by them.
Thank you very much. I think one of my great disappointments about, among many, on the Little House in the Prairie television series is that, which presumably has a Mankato locale, or at least they're living outside of Mankato, and every time they show what is supposed to be Mankato, it is so clearly a Southern California set that it's terrible, because you get such a clear sense from the Betsy Tacy books of a Mankato at about the same period, maybe a little later, that that was so much more interesting a place than that confounded set that they've dredged up for the Little House on the Prairie. Next, I'd like to introduce to you Dr. Ann Colley Boardman, who has been at the University of Minnesota, who was head of the English Department of University High School, and who is a writer and reviewer. And she is going to talk to us about other writers, other women writers in Minnesota. Dr. Boardman.
It's a delight to be with you this evening. I wish I knew how much you read and what you read and why you read. The topic, women writers in Minnesota, appealed to me and does very much indeed. But I told Nancy Woolworth months ago that though I work with books all the time in this tri-state area and have for a great many years, that to attempt to discuss even briefly the whole long list of women writers in Minnesota, or Minnesota women writers, however you would put it, would be just impossible. There had to be some stopping place. And so by agreement, we decided that I would talk primarily about Margaret Culkin Banning and Carol Brink. I would like to add my delight in hearing this account about Maud Hart Lovelace, because as a newcomer from West Virginia some years ago, when I came to the University of Minnesota, I think the very first book I read was Early Candlelight, I mean about this region, Early Candlelight by Maud Hart Lovelace. It taught me things that would have taken me a long while to have learned about the region and the earlier history of Minnesota. Margaret Culkin Banning and Carol Brink are truly Minnesota writers. Although Carol Brink was not born in Minnesota, she lived many, many years here, and St. Paul was her home, and I think in her heart is her home. Margaret Culkin Banning was born in Buffalo, Minnesota, lived most of her life in Duluth, was a graduate of Vassar College, was always interested in women's activities, women's affairs. She wasn't a militant Carrie Nation. She didn't go out and make her voice heard in strong, ringing tones, but her gracious personality and her convincing beliefs that women were equipped to do many things and not just a thing permeated her speeches, her writings, her stories. And I'm especially interested in something that she sent me, a book that she wrote, Women for Defense. And this was published at the time that the First World War was so actively engaging the attention of the women of this nation. Correction, the later World War. Margaret Culkin Banning is one of the best-known writers of America, and she is also one of the most able of women leaders. One of her chief interests as a writer and as a person has been the part that women play in American life and in the world. She has studied and observed this for many years, and it enables her to discuss with authority and understanding the relations of American women to the defense efforts. She has been a noted and very popular contributor for many years, and the list of magazines is almost as long as my arm, and other leading American periodicals, in case one might be omitted. She is the author of many books, and I'll tell you about a few of them very soon. The New York Times writes of this book, Women for Defense, an informative and stimulating book. It should be read by women of every interest and circumstances all over America. This is a book of balanced examination and challenge, not flattery. I know Mrs. Banning personally as I know Mrs. Brink. I know Mrs. Brink so well that Carol comes just normally in thinking of her rather than Mrs. Brink. But I have known Mrs. Banning for a long while. She makes her residence now permanently in Tryon, North Carolina. Formerly, she had two homes, Duluth and Tryon. She is widowed by the death of Mr. Leroy Sausage, her second husband, whom she married in 1944. She had a home in Tryon before she and Mr. Sausage, head of Republic Steel in Duluth, were married. He recognized her as a very active, dynamic, creative woman, and he agreed wholeheartedly to the use of Margaret Culkin Banning. Mr. Banning was her first name, but that was her professional name, and that she has used and uses and is known by everywhere. Now, Margaret Culkin Banning is not a great writer. She's made a tremendous contribution to the state of Minnesota, to the city of Duluth, to the city of Minneapolis, to all of us, all together and separately. Her writings are much better than the slick magazine type story that the supposedly bored and wearied woman picks up just to while a few minutes or hours away. Today there are very few slick magazines. Woman's Home Companion has gone a long, long time ago. Ladies Home Journal is still here. Sometimes ladies is not very conspicuous in the caption, and sometimes home is very, very small indeed. But Ladies Home Journal still, of course, is an active periodical. Saturday Evening Post, which was a market for Margaret Culkin Banning stories for years, is now available at $1 per issue, and the magazine certainly doesn't come out every week. It comes out at stated times, 4 and 6 weeks apart. I have always been intrigued by Mrs. Banning's creativity, by her perseverance, by her accomplishments. I have read every book I think she's read, and they number 32. And most of them are novels. And most of them are so absorbing that you find yourself turning the pages effortlessly. There are exceptions, naturally, but that is the general idea. But I've always said, and I'd say it if she were in here tonight, I probably would use a couple of qualifying statements as I made this definite statement, but I say that you remember the plot of Margaret Cuckin Banning's books 2 weeks, 3 weeks after you've read them. But if you can name the characters, you're better than I am. You just do not remember the characters. The novels all are problem novels. Her latest book, she's going to be 85 in March. Seems incredible because although age is a state of mind and people are ageless, 85 is a ripe age indeed. You don't have to use old as part of it. But believe me, Mrs. Banning has just sent off the manuscript of her 33rd book to Harper and Row Publishers, and it will be on the late spring list or the early fall list. I'm very disappointed, really, in this, because I thought a year ago, when The Will of Magna Townsend was published, that that was Mrs. Banning's finale. I thought then, and I think tonight, it is an autobiographical novel. And Nancy has heard me speak other places, and she has heard me say with conviction that I have evidence gathered from very good friends in Duluth over a period of years, friends who are not gossips, friends who depend on facts and do not speak quickly or thoughtlessly. But through them and through my great interest in Mrs. Banning's working habits and in her contribution to women in various activities other than writing, American women, I know certain facts about her private life, about her ill-mated marriage to Archie Banning, a charming man, but a no-good person who didn't pay his bills and who just depended upon his wife to see to it that coal bills and other utility bills and doctor's bills and so on were taken care of. They had four children, two of whom died, two of whom live and are living. The daughter has her PhD in chemistry. This book, Mrs. Banning wrote me, and I must read you what she says. You mention in your letter first that you thought necessity impelled me to begin writing. That is not the case, Mrs. Boardman. I began in college when I had no need of money, and my first 3 or 4 books were written and published in very prosperous days. Later on, I needed and was very glad to be able to earn by writing. But the compulsion to write always exceeded any interest in money. It would be a favor to me if you would state in any discussion of my most recent book, The Will of Magna Townsend, that it is not an autobiography. And I think it is. But I am saying it is not an autobiography. The story follows the lines of my own life to some extent, but the true story would be quite different. It has interested me that so many people have written about that novel to say, quote, "You have told the story of my life," unquote, so that the experience is widely shared. Mrs. Banning, was and is a Catholic, and after her separation from Mr. Banning, marriage was not in her mind at all for a period of time. Divorce, no. And then when she and Mr. Sausage met, it was real love, lasting and wonderful love. He was a very successful man, and she, of course, was extremely successful in her profession. Apart from being one of Duluth's most outstanding citizens, the 12th person chosen to the Duluth Hall of Fame, the friend of the chief figures in the Republican Party for many, many years, because she was chairman of Women's Activities and chairman of the former Governor Stassen's efforts to be nominated as President of the United States. She has sent me a number of pictures that I have, which I'll be glad to pass around if you're interested in them, showing her with Mrs. Eisenhower on one occasion, with Mrs. Roosevelt on another, not for political reasons in reference to that picture, but for activities of women in the nation during wartime. Here's a picture of General Grunther awarding her a very high merit, a recognition of merit, and shows her with the head of the American Legion giving her, as one of America's outstanding women, special awards. She couldn't possibly list all of the these's and those's that have gone into her professional life. To go back to the will of Magna Townsend, I have the book with me. Time does not permit me to read any from it. I'd love to, but it's a story of a very successful woman writer living in Duluth, Minnesota, who has been called by her attorney in for conference since her will, written some 40 years earlier, has very little meaning now, because a great many of the people that were named as beneficiaries have answered the call to another country, to another life, and are no longer here. And she has a great many grandchildren and relatives that weren't in the picture 40 years before. She comes into the office. The girls are very agog with curiosity to see this person who's known throughout the nation, but somehow they think really doesn't exist, that she just must be some glamorous individual with this particular name, Magna Townsend. And her attorney suggests she remake her will. And in remaking her will, the technique of the story is that she turns back to the happenings along the way. When she meets Mr. Sausage in real life, named something else in the book, there is this tear, this conflict between allegiance to faith, and her faith was deep and is, her Catholic faith, I should say, was and is deep. But she had suffered really a very great deal as the wife of an unsuccessful man who just took everything for granted and laid all the responsibilities in her lap. Well, the story goes on, and it ends with her death in a small North Carolina town. And the last chapter has to do, Tryon, incidentally, is less than 3,000 population. And Mrs. Manning is a very well-known figure. One of her novels, A Place in the Country, almost tore Tryon apart because everyone was trying to identify himself in the book, some successfully and some not so successfully. But I said to myself, and then in public, this is Finis for Margaret Culkin Banning, and how wonderfully interesting that in a creative manner, diluted somewhat, exaggerated somewhat, but nevertheless, from the standpoint of veracity, a true story of her struggles, of her success, of her turmoil, of the loss of her second husband, of her return to her original faith, of her homes in Wisconsin, Duluth, and Tryon, North Carolina. How wonderful that she could pull all those things together and give it to her readers in the will of Magna Townsend. So despite what she writes, I still think the book is more autobiographical than anything else, and I don't think her book next year can be as good as this book. A woman said to me yesterday at the Woman's Club in Minneapolis, "Don't you think her last two or three books have been less good than her earlier books?" And I said, "No, I don't. Some of her earlier books to me weren't as good as the later ones. She wrote 20 novels in 20 years. Now that's work. That's really sticking to it. As Mark Twain said, the way to produce is to apply the seat of your pants to the chair and stay at the desk before which that chair is." Well, and today the seat of the pants would apply to women, and it did apply to women and has applied to women many, many times and many, many years, even centuries, when Jane Austen, for example, was quietly writing her masterpieces without those people around her being aware of what she was doing. I think maybe you'd like to hear the rest of this, of the letter. "I am pleased that you will make my work a part of your seminar for the AAUW in St. Paul on December 3rd. I've been grateful to you for a number of thoughtful reviews, not only those of my own books, but others over your signature that I've read. I cannot help with a great deal of information or date, because a few years ago I sent all my papers, novels, and stories to Boston University, which has established a Margaret Culkin Banning collection in the Mugar, M-U-G-A-R, may not be pronounced Mugar, in the Mugar Library. But I hunted through my remaining files and took some material about my non-professional activities and closed these in case you and your audience might find them of interest. I'm also sending a list of my books and their publishers. Of course, it does not include anthologies or group publications, but it is a complete list of published books in this country. Many of them have been published in other countries, either fully or in digest form, but I'm sure that you do not want to bother with that list." And then I've read what she has to say about not having to write originally for money, and having to write later, yes, and not having written her autobiography in The Will of Magna Townsend. Now, I have two books with me here, neither of which I'm going to read from, but both of which I think you should know. And they're old. Minnesota Writes was published in 1945. And in going through this book recently, I was saddened to think that someone hasn't done the same thing more recently than 1945. The list of contents is absorbing. And we have, under different categories, the men and women, not just women, but men and women who have lived in Minnesota, written in Minnesota, written about Minnesota, and have in definite ways been associated with Minnesota. Many are gone. Many are greater than the facts indicate here, and many have gone by the wayside. So even though I have read most of these books and have worked in the field of books for a long, long while, I have forgotten some of them. But the book, if you don't know it, is history, and it is very interesting. It was compiled and edited by a Minneapolis teacher, Carmen Richards, Minnesota Writes, and you can get it at the public library. Maybe your own AAUW library has it, I don't know. The date of it is 1945, but it is really very interesting and valuable reading. The other that I have with me is a pamphlet from the public library, published by the University of Minnesota Library. It is a history of Minnesota books and authors by Grace Lee Newt. And the name Newt, of course, is associated with the Historical Society, with the University of Minnesota, with things substantial in reference to the history and the life of our state. Did you know, it says on the reverse side of this book, brochure really, that a famous Minnesota aviator won the Pulitzer Prize in literature? Well, I think you'd all know that. The man for whom Pike's Peak is named wrote the first important account of travel through Minnesota. Christopher Morley, called a Minnesotan, one of the few great drama critics in America. A world-famed Minnesotan refused to accept a Pulitzer Prize for one of his books, and so on. She has in this references to Carol Brink and Margaret Culkin Banning, but less than a paragraph to each one, and in many instances less than a paragraph to many other writers, because it is a short brochure, but it is an interesting one. 1958 is the time of that story. Now, there's something I want to go on record for, not necessarily in reference to Mrs. Banning and Mrs. Brink, but in reference to you and anyone with whom you speak. If you cut out a clipping for any reason whatsoever, if you're going to put in a letter to a friend, if you're going to put it into a file, going to put it into a file, date it and give your source. I was horrified, not just surprised, but horrified to see this material that Mrs. Banning has sent me has no date and no source on most of the information. Here's the lovely picture taken with Mrs. Eisenhower at the White House, and I look in vain for the date or the situation. A most interesting article taken from the Duluth paper, The Literary Idler, that was not Mrs. Banning. That's the name, nom de plume, of the person who wrote this article and who wrote articles about literature and literary figures in Duluth and environs. But no name, no date, even a picture, a Kodak picture, and you know how it is. You look at it and you say, well, was that taken in, and you'll name one or two or three places that you visited rather recently. Well, was it last summer or was it the summer before? Now, most of the people in the audience are young enough to know which summer it was, but there'll come a time when you'll wonder whether it was that summer or the other one. And so it's almost part of my credo to say, for heaven's sake, please date your source and give your source and date it, because that information means nothing if you're doing research. You know that, Nancy. If you had the most interesting article in the world, you didn't know where it came from, and you didn't know anything about the time, it would lessen in importance greatly. Now, Carol Brink is a different type of person. She's a feminine person, but she is not an ineffectual, silly somebody. She has a keen head, and she uses it, and she espouses women's place justly and rightly in many, many situations. Carol Brink's books are all at the Curlin Library at the University of Minnesota. Now, if you don't know the Curlin Library, I beg you to take a half day off if you possibly can find it and go over there and have one of the most interesting experiences. If you're interested in books at all, and I think you are, and people who write them, or you wouldn't be here tonight on this wintry night. Mr. Curlin was interested in children's books, had a tremendously important and varied collection. At the time of his death, left money to the University of Minnesota with the hoped-for statement and desire that a certain section of the library would be designated for his collection and for additions, because the money left would provide for additions. The library, University of Minnesota, cooperated beautifully, and there is this lovely, lovely room, huge room, with oriental rugs and big fireplace. Many of you, I can tell, have had the privilege of being there, and I hope more than once, because it's something that takes you back again. I spent almost a day there a week ago Monday, and it was a chilly wintry day. It was the Monday following that heavy Thursday snowstorm. And in the halls to the right, you go down the hall to the right of the Walter Library, because right at the end of that hall on the first floor is the Curlin Library. And on both sides were young people, men and women, studying together or separately, with their feet straight out in the lobby or in the hall and their backs against the wall. Couple of people here and there making love openly to each other. And right at the door of the Curlin Library, a young man and a woman sound asleep in each other's arms. Now, all of these things I've seen many places, in summer and in winter, but I couldn't believe the minute I opened the door into the Curlin Library, this tremendous difference. Oh, such quiet and peace and beauty and stability. Yes, stability. And I wanted to say to two or three of these people outside, shh, come in a minute, come in a minute. And then I thought, no, one of these days they will, their intellectual curiosity will lead them here or to some equal place. Now, Karen Nelson is the librarian of the Curlin Library, recently married. She's Karen Nelson Hoyle. And I had told her that I'd be over the Friday following that storm, and then I chickened out because I was going by bus, and I decided that the following Monday would be better. She had all of Carol Brink's manuscripts, all of her books, everything, on the big librarian's push cart or trolley. I didn't have to look up a thing. I worked amid that beauty, that luxury of comfort and detachment, and I grew so excited that I thought at times I'd just have to stand up and yell, whoopee, whoopee, come, come. Now, Carol Brink lives in California today. Her husband was chairman of the Department of Mathematics at the University of Minnesota for many, many years, Raymond Brink. And after his retirement, they went to La Jolla. Dr. Brink died a couple of years ago, and Carol is living on in California, but in a smaller place than they had in La Jolla. She wrote me this some time ago in reference to tonight. I came to professional writing by the direct route of doing what I liked to do best, and then gradually finding that I could sell the product. This light just isn't exactly right. Just a second. Maybe I'll leave it. To me, the pleasure, this is better. To me, the pleasure of writing has almost always come first, and if it sells, then that's an extra bonus. So perhaps I'm not really a professional writer after all, just a writer. I am always happiest when I have some writing in hand, writing that is going well. This is not to suggest that it is not hard work to get the right word in the right place, to try to convey to readers some of the interest or emotion, however diluted this is in the final outcome, that was originally felt. This takes staying power and stamina as well as inspiration. To aspiring writers, I would say, teach your senses to work for you. Read others' work critically and appreciatively in order to learn from it. The life of the mind and the daily life we lead are so closely bound up together that what we have fully imagined will enrich our living, and what we have consciously experienced will enrich our thinking or our writing. Now she speaks of the Gothic novel which she's written. And before I talk about that ever so briefly, I want to say something that I'm sure you all know. She is the writer of juveniles, the writer of adult books, and two nonfiction books, one on the Twin Cities, which is excellent, but which ended the very minute that she put the period to the last sentence on the last page, because the Twin Cities go on and on. What happened this morning is behind us. What's happening now is different from or related to what happened this morning. So the story of the Twin Cities would have to be continuing. But if you want to read the story of the Twin Cities up to that last period, then get Carol Brink's book about the Twin Cities, published by Macmillan, because it is first rate. The other nonfiction book she wrote is Harps in the Wind. Beautiful title, Harps in the Wind. And it was about the singing Hutchinsons of Minnesota. I have written and had published some biographies, and she said to me, "Oh, Anne, I would rather do a fiction, work of fiction anytime, than do a work of nonfiction. The research is so detailed, and some of the living relatives were still in the picture when she wrote Harps in the Wind, and again certain things had to be changed because relatives didn't like this or that, and of course that's pretty difficult to do. Her first adult novel, after many years of great success as a juvenile writer, was Buffalo Coat, and I have that here with me tonight. But she has written more juveniles than adults. Her adult books are good, but they're nothing compared with her juveniles. As long as there are 10-year-old girls in the world, not in the United States, there will be readers of Caddy Woodlawn. Caddy Woodlawn, why, we loved her and we love her. Caddy Woodlawn was Carol Brink's grandmother. Carolyn Woodland was her name. She remembered all of her childhood experiences in Dunn County, Wisconsin, not too far from Menominee. And just 3 years ago, Menominee and Dunn County Historical Institute, aided by the Wisconsin State Historical Society, took 6 acres of the original land, transferred the original home that had been occupied by Caddy's parents, and they made of it the Caddy Woodlawn Park. And it is there in perpetuity with only one thing to annoy a meticulous reader and a lover of Caddy Woodlawn. That book won the John Newbery Award, you know, in 1936. The book was published in 1935. And if I ask you, is Newbery spelled with two R's or one R? Don't say out loud, it's a rhetorical question. It's spelled with one R, John Newbery. He was an English bookseller and a writer of children's books in the 18th century. And such a love for books Mr. Curlin possessed, and the people who instituted the Newbery Award for the best book in children's literature just had to name it after John Newbery. But at the historical plaque down in Dunn County, out from Menominee, at the Caddy Woodlawn Park, John Newbery with two R's. And that, of course, is something lots of people won't catch and lots of people will catch. The first juvenile that she wrote in 1934 was Anything Can Happen on a River. She and her husband and their two small children went to France for a year, and they lived near a river, and the children were having so much fun on and near the river that she wrote this book, Anything Can Happen on a River. And it was received very well. And then the next year she wrote K Caddy Woodlot. Now, she was not born in Minnesota. She was born in Moscow, Idaho, and that's the site of the University of Idaho. And she said for many years she's traveled abroad a great deal with her husband and since his death by herself, with friends or associates, but without Mr. Brink. And she said that again and again, people checking her passport would say, oh, Russia, you're from Russia, Moscow. They didn't know there was a Moscow in the United States. And she tells with pride that it's a very lovely little university community in Idaho. Her grandmother, who'd been brought up in Dunn County, Wisconsin, was out in Moscow, Idaho, with her husband, the doctor, who's written about in Buffalo Coat, because in the early days, the small town doctor was known way in the distance. There goes Doc, because they could see his buffalo coat. And Caddy Woodlot told these stories to Carol, whose parents died when she was very, very young. One parent died when she was five, he was five. When Carol was five, one died when she was eight. And it was the grandmother who had good common sense and an aunt who had more love than good common sense, but whose love was stabilized by the salt of common sense that the grandmother possessed. And these stories that make up Caddy Woodlot are fictionized very slightly. I have a list of the total number of books that Carol has written to date. There are 27 of them. And she is to have a Gothic published next spring. And people, she'll be 80 years old, the 28th of December. And it doesn't seem possible that she would go out into the field of Gothic now. But she said, told me a year ago in August when she was here, that she and a friend of hers decided they'd go to a writing class that, and think of all these books to her credit, that the teacher was teaching the writing of Gothic novels. And they went out of curiosity, whether intellectual curiosity or not, I don't know, but they went. And after a little while, one said to the other, I can write one, can't you? And the friend had never written anything. And Carol said, I'm willing to try. So the two women wrote their Gothic stories, and they submitted them to the publishers. Now, this was before, a year ago in August, because she was here then and told me this personally at the time. She said they submitted their stories, and within a very short time, she got a special delivery letter from the editor in the East with a $3,000 check enclosed acceptance. And her friend got a letter, I don't know whether it came special delivery or not, probably didn't, rejecting her manuscript. And Carol said, never in my life did I want a rejection so badly. Oh, how I wanted my friend to have her first book accepted for publication, because Carol had all these 20-some books to her name and fame, because, as I said, Caddy Woodlot will live forever. It's been translated into every language you could name and I could name. Put together, there'd be languages additional. And then she said to her friend, why don't you send a chapter and a query letter off to another publisher? And the answer came back immediately by special delivery. We like your book. Send the whole thing to us. And any other ideas you have or any other books on the hopper. So now her friend has written the second Gothic novel. But this is what Carol said. We're all just dying to read it. And it doesn't come and it doesn't come. And she says, the Gothic, I'm sorry to say, and this letter was written September 25th of this year, the Gothic, I'm sorry to say, will not be out until May 1976. Bantam Books bought it a year ago last February, and I have never had a book so long in the making. When I complained, the editor said, well, when we see something good, we buy it, even if we have a long list of books to publish first. So with that sop and the fact that they paid much better advanced royalty than Macmillan ever did, I suppose I can't grumble. It is called, now get the name of it, it is called the Bellini Look, B-E-L-L-I-N-I, and I won't ask a rhetorical question, who's Bellini? Many of you know. The Bellini book, and is set in Venice during the Depression period. It was fun to do, and I'm not ashamed of it. Now I have to stop because my time has gone over, but I must tie Carol Brink with women in modern life. Carol Brink has made more contributions to the betterment of women as a member of the Faculty Women's Club of the University of Minnesota, as a neighbor, as a mother, as a creative artist, as a person who just makes people feel bigger than they are. And that's a wonderful accomplishment, because when you feel you're bigger than you are, you accomplish things more than you ever thought you could accomplish. Now, I have reviews of three of Mrs. Banning's books with me, two of which I've written myself for the Minneapolis Sunday Tribune, Lifeboat Number 2 and Mesabi. That's really a very good book, Mesabi, about the taconite industry, which the leading character would never acknowledge at all and who ends quite disillusioned by happenings. And then I have The Will of Magna Townsend, the book and the review. One of the Juveniles, Winter Cottage, and the first adult book, Buffalo Coat. Many critics of the time said that the first page of Buffalo Coat had some of the best writing in it that they, the critics, had ever seen, because immediately you get the feel, you know the person, you see what's happening, and you're just all ready for something unusually good. So many people said to me when Buffalo Coat came out, how could Mrs. Brink do this to us? It's bam, bam, boom, boom, and another one hit the dust. Because in Idaho Territory, where the book is laid in the mid-19th century, it was rough. And Doc, with his buffalo coat, had all sorts of experiences that were real, but were very different from what Caddy Woodlawn and Magical Melons and Anything Can Happen on a River and all of these wonderful books before had offered. So, my friends, whatever your status is in this women's movement, militant, interested, activist, participant, onlooker, be true to yourself and cultivate your own God-given talents. Don't wait until another time before you start to write, if that's what you're interested in. Don't wait until another time to read that very good book or to do that particular thing. Try in some way to coordinate that with this and you'll succeed. So please reread Carol Brink for her quiet contribution to women and her continuing contribution, Stable, and Margaret Cochran Banning's active participation in politics, in citizenship, and in the field of fiction writing. I thank you.
Let's take a 5-minute coffee break and then come back and ask some questions.